Chapter 145. Flight, Inspector Bucket of the Detective, has not yet struck his great blow, as just now chronicled, but is yet refreshing himself with sleep preparatory to his field day, when through the night, and along the freezing wintry roads a chaise and pair comes out of Lincolnshire, making its way towards London. Railroads shall soon traverse all this country, and with a rattle and a glare the engine and train shall shoot like a meteor over the wide night landscape, turning the moon paler. But as yet such things are non-existent in these parts, though not wholly unexpected. Preparations are afoot, measurements are made, ground is staked out. Bridges are begun, and there not yet the united peers desolately look at one another over roads, and streams like brick and mortar couples with an obstacle to their union. Fragments of embankments are thrown up, and left as precipices with torrents of rusty carts and barrows tumbling over them. Tripods of tall poles appear on hilltops, where there are rumors of tunnels. Everything looks chaotic, and abandoned in full hopelessness. Along the freezing roads, and through the night, the post chaise makes its way without a railroad on its mind. Mrs. Rouncewell, so many years housekeeper at Chesney Wold, sits within the chaise, and by her side sits Mrs. Bagnet with her gray cloak and umbrella. The old girl would prefer the bar in front, as being exposed to the weather, and a primitive sort of perch more in accordance with her usual course of traveling, but Mrs. Rouncewell is too thoughtful of her comfort to admit of her proposing it. The old lady cannot make enough of the old girl. She sits, in her stately manner, holding her hand, and regardless of its roughness, puts it often to her lips. "You are a mother, my dear soul," says she many times, "and you found out my George's mother." "Why, George," returns Mrs. Bagnet, "was always free with me, ma'am, and when he said at our house to my Woolwich, that of all the things my Woolwich could have to think of when he grew to be a man, the comfortablest would be that he had never brought a sorrowful line into his mother's face, or turned a hair of her head gray, then I felt sure, from his way, that something fresh had brought his own mother into his mind. I had often known him say to me, in past times, that he had behaved bad to her." "Never, my dear," returns Mrs. Rouncewell, bursting into tears. "My blessing on him, never. He was always fond of me, and loving to me, was my George. But he had a bold spirit, and he ran a little wild, and went for a soldier. And I know he waited at first, in letting us know about himself, till he should rise to be an officer. And when he didn't rise, I know he considered himself beneath us, and wouldn't be a disgrace to us. For he had a lion heart, had my George, always from a baby." The old lady's hands stray about her as of yore, while she recalls, all in a tremble, what a likely lad, what a fine lad, what a gay, good-humored, clever lad he was, how they all took to him down at Chesney Wold, how Sir Leicester took to him when he was a young gentleman, how the dogs took to him, how even the people who had been angry with him forgave him the moment he was gone, poor boy. And now to see him after all, and in a prison too. And the broad stomacher heaves, and the quaint upright old-fashioned figure bends under its load of affectionate distress. Mrs. Bagnet, with the instinctive skill of a good warm heart, leaves the old housekeeper to her emotions for a little while, not without passing the back of her hand across her own motherly eyes, and presently chirps up in her cheery manner, "So I says to George, when I goes to call him in to tea, he pretended to be smoking his pipe outside, 'What ails you this afternoon, George, for gracious sake? I have seen all sorts, and I have seen you pretty often in season, and out of season, abroad and at home, and I never see you so melancholy penitent.'" Apostrophe Y, Mrs. Bagnet, apostrophe says George, "It's because I am melancholy and penitent both, this afternoon, that you see me so." Apostrophe What have you done, old fellow? Apostrophe I says. "Why, Mrs. Bagnet," apostrophe says George, shaking his head, "what I have done, has been done this many a long year, and is best not tried to be undone now. If I ever get to heaven, it won't be for being a good son to a widowed mother. I say no more. Apostrophe now, ma'am. When George says to me that it's best not tried to be undone now, I have my thoughts as I have often had before, and I draw it out of George, how he comes to have such things on him that afternoon. Then George tells me that he has seen by chance, at the lawyer's office, a fine old lady that has brought his mother plain before him, and he runs on about that old lady till he quite forgets himself, and paints her picture to me as she used to be, years upon years back. So I says to George when he has done, who is this old lady he has seen? And George tells me it's Mrs. Rouncewell, housekeeper for more than half a century to the Dedlock family down at Chesney Wold in Lincolnshire. George has frequently told me before that he's a Lincolnshire man, and I says to my old Lignum that night, Lignum, that's his mother for 5 and 4 tie pound. Apostrophe, all this Mrs. Bagnet now relates for the 20th time at least within the last 4 hours. Trilling it out like a kind of bird, with a pretty high note, that it may be audible to the old lady above the hum of the wheels. Bless you, and thank you, says Mrs. Rouncewell. Bless you, and thank you, my worthy soul. Dear heart, cries Mrs. Bagnet in the most natural manner. No thanks to me, I am sure. Thanks to yourself, ma'am, for being so ready to pay him. And mind once more, ma'am, what you had best do on finding George, to be your own son is to make him for your sake have every sort of help, to put himself in the right, and clear himself of a charge, of which he is as innocent as you or me. It won't do to have truth and justice on his side. He must have law and lawyers, exclaims the old girl, apparently persuaded that the latter form a separate establishment, and of dissolved partnership with truth and justice forever and a day. He shall have, says Mrs. Rouncewell, all the help that can be got for him in the world, my dear. I will spend all I have, and thankfully, to procure it. Sir Leicester will do his best, the whole family will do their best. I know something, my dear, and will make my own appeal, as his mother parted from him all these years, and finding him in a jail at last. The extreme disquietude of the old housekeeper's manner in saying this, her broken words, and the wringing of her hands make a powerful impression on Mrs. Bagnet, and would astonish her, but that she refers them all to her sorrow for her son's condition. And yet Mrs. Bagnet wonders too, why Mrs. Rouncewell should murmur so distractedly, my lady, my lady, my lady, over and over again. The frosty night wears away, and the dawn breaks, and the post-chaise comes rolling on through the early mist like the ghost of a chaise departed. It has plenty of spectral company in ghosts of trees and hedges, slowly vanishing and giving place to the realities of day. London reached, the travellers alight, the old housekeeper in great tribulation and confusion, Mrs. Bagnet quite fresh, and collected as she would be if her next point, with no new equipage and outfit, were the Cape of Good Hope, the Island of Ascension, Hong Kong, or any other military station. But when they set out for the prison, where the trooper is confined, the old lady has managed to draw about her, with her lavender-colored dress, much of the staid calmness which is its usual accompaniment. A wonderfully grave, precise, and handsome piece of old china she looks, though her heart beats fast and her stomacher is ruffled more than even the remembrance of this wayward son has ruffled it these many years. Approaching the cell, they find the door opening, and a warder in the act of coming out. The old girl promptly makes a sign of entreaty to him to say nothing, assenting with a nod, he suffers them to enter as he shuts the door. So George, who is writing at his table, supposing himself to be alone, does not raise his eyes, but remains absorbed. The old housekeeper looks at him, and those wandering hands of hers are quite enough for Mrs. Bagnet's confirmation, even if she could see the mother and the son together, knowing what she knows, and doubt their relationship. Not a rustle of the housekeeper's dress, not a gesture, not a word betrays her. She stands looking at him as he writes on, all unconscious, and only her fluttering hands give utterance to her emotions. But they are very eloquent, very, very eloquent. Mrs. Bagnet understands them. They speak of gratitude, of joy, of grief, of hope, of inextinguishable affection, cherished with no return since this stalwart man was a stripling, of a better son loved less, and this son loved so fondly and so proudly, and they speak in such touching language, that Mrs. Bagnet's eyes brim up with tears and they run glistening down her sun-brown face. George Rouncewell. Oh, my dear child, turn and look at me. The trooper starts up, clasps his mother round the neck, and falls down on his knees before her. Whether in a late repentance, whether in the first association that comes back upon him, he puts his hands together as a child does when it says its prayers, and raising them towards her breast, bows down his head, and cries, "My George, my dearest son, always my favorite, and my favorite still, where have you been these cruel years and years? Grown such a man too, grown such a fine strong man. Grown so like what I knew he must be, if it pleased God he was alive." She can ask, and he can answer, nothing connected for a time. All that time the old girl, turned away, leans one arm against the whitened wall, leans her honest forehead upon it, wipes her eyes with her serviceable gray cloak, and quite enjoys herself like the best of old girls as she is. "Mother," says the trooper when they are more composed, "forgive me first of all, for I know my need of it." Forgive him. She does it with all her heart and soul. She always has done it. She tells him how she has had it written in her will, these many years, that he was her beloved son George. She has never believed any ill of him, never. If she had died without this happiness, and she is an old woman now, and can't look to live very long, she would have blessed him with her last breath, if she had had her senses, as her beloved son George. "Mother, I have been an undutiful trouble to you, and I have my reward. But of late years I have had a kind of glimmering of a purpose in me too. When I left home I didn't care much, mother, I am afraid not a great deal for leaving, and went away and listed, harum scarum, making believe to think that I cared for nobody, no not I, and that nobody cared for me." The trooper has dried his eyes and put away his handkerchief, but there is an extraordinary contrast between his habitual manner of expressing himself, and carrying himself, and the softened tone in which he speaks, interrupted occasionally by a half-stifled sob. "So I wrote a line home, mother, as you too well know, to say I had listed under another name, and I went abroad. Abroad, at one time I thought I would write home next year, when I might be better off. And when that year was out, I thought I would write home next year, when I might be better off. And when that year was out again, perhaps I didn't think much about it. So on, from year to year, through a service of 10 years, till I began to get older, and to ask myself, why should I ever write? I don't find any fault, child, but not to ease my mind, George. Not a word to your loving mother, who was growing older too." This almost overturns the trooper afresh, but he sets himself up with a great, rough, sounding clearance of his throat. "Heaven forgive me, mother, but I thought there would be small consolation then in hearing anything about me. There were you, respected and esteemed. There was my brother, as I read in chance North Country papers now and then, rising to be prosperous and famous. There was I, a dragoon, roving, unsettled, not self-made like him, but self-unmade, all my earlier advantages thrown away, all my little learning unlearned, nothing picked up, but what unfitted me for most things that I could think of. What business had I to make myself known? After letting all that time go by me, what good could come of it? The worst was past with you, mother. I knew by that time, being a man, how you had mourned for me, and wept for me, and prayed for me, and the pain was over, or was softened down, and I was better in your mind as it was." The old lady sorrowfully shakes her head, and taking one of his powerful hands, lays it lovingly upon her shoulder. No, I don't say that it was so, Mother, but that I made it out to be so. I said just now, what good could come of it? Well, my dear mother, some good might have come of it to myself, and there was the meanness of it. He would have sought me out. He would have purchased my discharge. He would have taken me down to Chesney Wold. He would have brought me, and my brother's family together. He would all have considered anxiously how to do something for me, and set me up as a respectable civilian. But how could any of you feel sure of me when I couldn't so much as feel sure of myself? How could you help regarding as an encumbrance, and a discredit to you an idle dragooning chap who was an encumbrance and a discredit to himself, excepting under discipline? How could I look my brother's children in the face, and pretend to set them an example? I, the vagabond boy who had run away from home, and been the grief and unhappiness of my mother's life. No, George. Apostrophe such were my words, Mother, when I passed this in review before me. You have made your bed. Now, lie upon it. Mrs. Rouncewell, drawing up her stately form, shakes her head at the old girl with a swelling pride upon her, as much as to say, I told you so. The old girl relieves her feelings, and testifies her interest in the conversation, by giving the trooper a great poke between the shoulders with her umbrella. This action she afterwards repeats, at intervals, in a species of affectionate lunacy, never failing, after the administration of each of these remonstrances, to resort to the whitened wall and the grey cloak again. This was the way I brought myself to think, Mother, that my best amends was to lie upon that bed I had made, and die upon it. And I should have done it, though I have been to see you more than once down at Chesney Wold, when you little thought of me, but for my old comrade's wife here, who I find, has been too many for me. But I thank her for it. I thank you for it, Mrs. Bagnet, with all my heart and might. To which Mrs. Bagnet responds with two pokes. And now the old lady impresses upon her son George, her own dear recovered boy, her joy and pride, the light of her eyes, the happy close of her life, and every fond name she can think of, that he must be governed by the best advice obtainable by money and influence, that he must yield up his case to the greatest lawyers that can be got, that he must act in this serious plight as he shall be advised to act, and must not be self-willed, however right, but must promise to think only of his poor old mother's anxiety and suffering until he is released, or he will break her heart. Mother, 'tis little enough to consent to, returns the trooper, stopping her with a kiss. Tell me what I shall do, and I'll make a late beginning and do it. Mrs. Bagnet, you'll take care of my mother, I know. A very hard poke from the old girl's umbrella. If he will bring her acquainted with Mr. Jarndyce and Miss Summerson, she will find them of her way of thinking, and they will give her the best advice and assistance. And, George, says the old lady, we must send with all haste for your brother. He is a sensible sound man as they tell me out in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.